Welcome to SoFlow by Lucas Millar. Lucas's latest collection of 13 short stories, ranging from the gross and silly to heart-wrenching thrillers of cosmic proportions. Join Lucas as he takes you beyond the beaches and shows you the dark side of the Sunshine State. Welcome to SoFlow, a collection of weird Florida horror by Lucas Millar. Available January 14th, 2024. Brought to you by the Evil Cookie Publishing. Welcome to another episode of Dead Headspace. I'm your host, Patrick R. McDonough, joined always by my friend, Brennan LaFaro. Say hello, Brennan.
Hello, everybody.
And today, we are also joined by our other friend, Candace Nola. Say hello, Candace.
Hello.
We're talking to Daniel Brom, author of many a book. Today, we're talking probably mainly about The Serpent's Shadow. Say hello, Daniel.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Absolutely. So let's just dive into it. What got you into horror?
I'm not sure. And the reason I say that is I never really, looking back, I always was into horror. I never really thought of myself as being into horror or writing horror. So when I first started selling stories to Cemetery Dance magazine, just pushing 20 plus years ago, is when maybe I thought, maybe there's something to this horror stuff, and maybe I should start educating myself and getting into it. And oh, what a great what a great journey it's been.
Absolutely. Brennan, I feel like you got something to reply with.
Yeah, the thing is that I you know, that's our go-to question, and you certainly write in the horror genre, but you tend to dabble between genres. And when you sit down to write a story, I wonder how you approach it in terms of genre, or if you that's even a consideration, or if it's so far at the back of your mind that you don't even bother with it.
Now, as in today, I think it's it is something that does come into my mind. But when especially when I was starting out, and for a great deal of my stories that were published, I either just simply didn't, I want to say it was so far from my mind, but I didn't even know enough about genre to have it be a consideration. At like one point, I thought I was a science fiction fantasy author, but I just was so bad with the dartboard, I was like missing the mark so badly. But I guess that's to say, like, I'd probably go in the category of like, for whatever reason, I was lucky enough or unlucky enough not to be thinking about genre as part of my process. The unlucky part of it is that it especially when you're starting out, it could be hard to place and sell stories. The lucky part of it is I tend to dodge the bullets or just gain the benefits of not having that interfere with my process. If it could be said that sometimes that's a thing that happens.
Absolutely. And I kind of want to go down that rabbit hole because there's something so freeing. I want to use the word innocent. I don't know if it's the right one, about being kind of a fledgling writer.
And not about me, but yeah.
No judgment. But
this is a no judgment podcast.
Absolutely. But I'm thinking about, like, you know, writing those initial stories, and not even because nowadays when you have experienced so much more, both as a writer and as a reader and as like a fan of the genre, if you say I'm writing this story about genre, it's almost like, you know, don't think about the blue elephant. You're going to think about it. You're going to actively go down one of those paths, and oh shit, I tried not to write a horror story and now it's this.
And there's no judgment on both sides of that coin, I think. I mean, I think there's there's amazing benefits, I think, to both both processes. And many writers that I know, my favorite writers are also on both sides of that spectrum. One of my favorite writers is Kelly Link, and I listen to a lot of what she has to say, and she's such a smooth and organic writer who writes in many genres. And I thought for sure from reading her work that she would be, you know, like a pantser, you know, no planning, doesn't think about it. But when she talks about her creative process, it's the most inorganic, most thought out, not judging it, thing. If she wants to write a story about rocket ships, she's like, I want to read every story about rocket ships. I want to know everything there is about rocket ship fiction. And then she's like, I want to find the hole. And what she means by the hole is she wants to find that kind of gap where she can fit in there. So it's like weird. So it like comes out to, it seems like, or it feels like it's like the organic and the quote unquote innocent in the no judgment way, but it's quite the opposite. It's a very thought out thing. And that process works for her, you know, and it works. And it's also possible just to be on the other side of the spectrum of just being completely just following the muse and having like that old fashioned, like, oh my God, like inspiration hit me. I saw a rocket ship and I'm just going to write my feelings about rocket ships and spin gold. I do not spin gold. I have to work very hard to get something that looks and feels like a story that another human will recognize as a story.
Okay, so let's go there. What when, you know, specifically in short fiction, from I'm going to write a story and maybe I don't even know what it's going to be about to finished product ready to submit somewhere, what does the process look like?
A lot of revision. You know, I feel most comfortable in the process of revision, because that's where I feel like I can bring what I've learned, bring the craft into it. Traditionally, first drafts used to be really hard for me. I've done it so much where things are kind of shifting, where, you know, I feel a lot more comfortable writing better first drafts, having less revision. But that is that's at least the craft process. As far as the inspiration goes, and this answers, I think, it goes to your first question about, am I thinking about genre? And most of the time, if left to my own devices, as if I'm not commissioned to work, if I'm just like organically, like, oh, a short story comes from out of the blue. Well, where is out of the blue? For me, I've just noticed that my process is different than a lot of writers in that my inspiration tends to come from setting. It's often like I want to write about a place, or it's a place that I can't stop thinking about. It's a place that all the notes come, or the story bits, and you know that's the magic that you can't really necessarily teach. And then once I have that inspiration down, I start to hammer it and revise it into shape of something that looks like, okay, a short story on planet Earth. Then I start thinking about characters, conflict, and how they fit into the setting. I've tried, and I do work in other ways, but like if left to my own devices, that's the way I would work.
But you got to do what works for you, you know? That's we can all sit here and nitpick our own processes, but whatever gets the story done.
That's a great advice, though. You know, whatever, you know, all the rules are fantastic and one should know the rules, but also like don't bow to the tyranny of the rules. You know, I don't care. You know, the great Stephen King has said amazing things, but also it's like, if that doesn't work for you, you got to get it done.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, also, Patrick.
What I was going to say real quick before I throw it to you, Patrick, is I think that it's so true in pretty much any art form too. You know the rules, you learn the rules, and then you gotta start there in order to break them. You know, as a musician and a writer, those two things are completely equitable between both arts. And I mean, I even think of like my wife is a baker, and she'll even say that, you know, when you're working with sourdough, that you have to learn how to do it right, and then you can bend those rules and kind of create things that are a little outside the box and don't, you know, aren't boring, are more interesting and tasteful or whatever the baker word is. I'm not good at that shit. Patrick,
I love that. I love that thought though.
Yeah.
She's a great baker. Yeah. So you reminded me of a quote. I pulled it up by Pablo Picasso. He said, "Learn the rules like a pro so you can break them like an artist." And I think that goes along with the theme of this episode. Daniel, I want to go back a few years. Even before the show started, 2019, you interviewed my favorite author ever, Peter Straub, in person. We did it on Zoom. So
yeah, I just watched that to prepare for the show to see what I was getting into. I was like, all right, let's catch up on the Deadhead podcast. And that was the number two episode I watched. First was with Mariana Enriquez and John Langan and Paul Tremblay too. But yeah, Peter Straub.
Wow. I want to know what it was like talking to him in person, and just what did you walk away with one or two things from him that you feel won't ever leave you as a person and a writer?
Man, great question. And cut this if it's not cool to say it there. I can just give you the link where people can.
Absolutely.
There's still a link out there where people can. I think it's on someone else's podcast, or it's up there where you can hear that full interview. And it's a great interview, not because I gave a great interview. It was just a great interview, just because of the generosity and wisdom of what Peter had to say. So I guess the thing that's coming. There's so many things one can say about Peter Straub, but the one that's coming to my mind right now, and rest in peace, we lost him. Is that generosity towards humankind, towards other writers, and just his sheer love and knowledge for fiction and storytelling. So when I did speak with him, he was a guest of my show Nighttime Logic, which used to run at the Lovecraft Bar in New York City, which isn't there anymore. He was most interested, again, what we seem to be talking about, Kelly Link. You know, he was reluctant. He was, you know, he told me, he's like, oh, I'm reluctant. I've talked about my work so much. And I was like, let's talk about, the way I pitched it to him was, let's talk about the work you edited. Let's talk about your favorite stuff. And we share a love of Robert Aikman, and we share a love of Kelly Link. And, you know, the whole first half of our interview was about, you know, the writers that he loves, fabulism, the interstitial stuff. And yeah, so that's one of the things. That's one of the things I take away from Peter Straub, but there's so much more.
Were you nervous talking to him?
But by that point, no, because I was fortunate enough that I had known him for about 20 years. The first few times that I did meet him, which are, I would tell the story on the podcast, but they fall into the category of what happens at Nikon stays at Nikon. But I'll just say that some of my friends, the first time I went to Nikon, hazed me pretty humorously, and they definitely involved, you know, Peter Straub at high levels of intoxication. We'll just leave it there. And yes, I was nervous.
I understand it. I still get not nervous. I don't know what the word would be, but thinking about talking to him, there's some people that leave a mark on you forever, and you know, it doesn't have to be a writer you look up to,
yeah,
and they just leave a happy place in your heart that you can always return to. So that was my experience, and sounds like it's the same with yours and every other person I've ever talked to that knew him.
Yeah, I just have chills. Right, you just gave me chills right now thinking about it. Just trying to think about that very.
Nah, I not bullshitting. Yeah. I did too, because how many people do you know that get to that level that just offer their heart to y'all, you know, whoever? I mean, I didn't know him. I just tweeted him and he accepted. That's who he was.
Yeah, he really has a passion for, you know, for us, you know, not us specifically, but yeah, for people who are passionate about work, about the genre. And that's, That's a wonderful thing. I just was thinking right now, you know, it's not a thing you really you know, talk about when talking about his work, when I'm thinking about his passion, just, you know, what memory comes to me now. He loved fiction, and I mentioned Robert Aikman and mentioned Kelly Link, but Peter Straub's face lights up when you talk about Stephen King.
Yeah.
Man, yeah. I mean, of course, they're friends and collaborators.
Yeah.
But we all love Stephen King, but, you know, absent Misery and Annie Wilkes, I think Peter Straub is Stephen King's number one fan. Just to see him talk about Stephen King, to see him talk with Stephen King. I never met Stephen King, wasn't in the presence, but Stephen King once gave like a lecture with Owen at like a local thing, and Peter was like in the front row, and you just sort of, you know, you just see the physical joy, and that's, you know, that's another thing that stays with me. It's like, you know, why do we write? Why are we fans? Why are we readers? And, you know, that's one of the things that Peter embodied to me as well.
That's beautiful. Here's to Peter.
Cheers, Candace, to Peter Straub.
Absolutely. Candace, jump in, please.
Hello.
Hey, Candace.
So how do I follow up conversation about Straub, right?
He's a showstopper.
Right? Because there's always so much to say about him. Speaking of inspirations, can you tell us about some of your other ones? Other than Straub.
Yeah.
And King, because we all say King. Because I think it's obligatory at this point.
It's obligatory, but it's one of those like cliches that's just true. That's why maybe never. It's like I'm not, you know, you're like Bart Simpson. I will not talk about Straub and King. I will not talk about Straub and King. But you have to talk about Straub and King. And also, just sort of never. No one really seems to mind on that. But that's a great thing. Two people relatively far from Straub and King, and who are my two first genre inspirations were Kenneth Lee and Lucia Shepherd. When I was a teen or a preteen, on the younger side of teens, just hunting for books in my local library, I pulled two books off the shelf, just judging a book by their covers. I pulled in my local library, there were some Arkham House editions of Kenneth Lee's collection, Dreams of Dark and Light, and Lucia Shepherd's The Jaguar Hunter, both beautiful covers. And I was like, oh, these look like cool books. Let me take them home. And let's just make an emoji of my 14-year-old head exploding. You know, both of those writers bring something really, I didn't have words for it then. I just know I was just like, you know, that hunger, that drinking in, that joy, and also your world expanding. For Kenneth Lee, for me, it was, wow, these are stories where anything can happen, and everything does happen. And I, upon much reflection, when I think of Tanith Lee and I think of the lesson she brought to me, I think of it as just like no borders, no judgment, no reservations on your imagination. And Tanith Lee, after I learned about her, she is one of those writers who is said to actually be the ultimate pantser, in that she is said to channel. She doesn't revise. She's even said to, like, you have to channel from dreams, or almost channel from work. And then the other is Lucia Shepherd. And, you know, Lucia Shepherd, the same thing in his wild imagination, but his prose for a gruff, rough and sort of expat man, masculine guy, his writing is just so gentle and beautiful and poetic. Maybe naysayers might say purple, but maybe perhaps in the way that, like, you know, it's like the most, you know, the most, what's that tequila commercial? You know, I'm the most interesting man alive. Things will fail in a lesser man. You know, maybe I think most writers try to write beautiful and it comes across, you know, as just purple and thing. But, you know, Lucius just has the most beautiful, clear, evocative prose. And he really was a setting based. I don't know about his process because I only knew him as a fan. I never got a chance to know him as a writer. But Lucia Shepherd brought to me as a reader. And then ultimately, that was what I wanted to do as a writer until I realized it. of feeling like I went somewhere, taking me somewhere where I've never been or might never be before, and that a lot of his writing takes place in Central America, not exclusively, but it was definitely those Central American stories that really captured my imagination. And later in life, he was a very important, I think, person in the development of horror and fiction, even though he's not a weird fiction, even though he's not thought about that way, but we can put a mark on that, come back to that. So that's my wordy answer for your top two inspirations besides Straub and King. Go.
Yeah.
Great question.
So since we moved into Central America, that pretty much brings us to the theme of your novel. So let's get into that. If I were to be someone new approaching you and your work for the first time, how would you pitch this story to me?
How would I pitch the novel, The Serpent Shadow? Mm-hmm. Let's see. How would I? I'd probably do it differently every time. I'd say it's a story. It takes place in the 1980s in Mexico, and it appears on the surface to be something you've seen before. Star-crossed love, young teenagers finding passion, finding trouble, kind of getting their noses into somewhere they're not supposed to be. And it very quickly, I think, inverts and becomes something a lot different and perhaps a lot more than that surface level.
Yeah.
Or I could maybe say it's a cosmic horror. It's a story about a war, about two different peoples that are using dark magic that they don't know, they don't control, and story about nations and choices and futures and monsters. Maybe it's that too. In a different elevator, I'd maybe throw that pitch.
Hey, whatever works. Why this particular story? Where did the concept come from?
I'm not sure. This is one that it was a bit different than writing the short stories. It was closer to being more of an organic writing experience, but when I think about it, Central America, like, so there's the Lucia Shepherd influence, right? Like, there's definitely, I'm interested in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to go to that part of the world when I was a youngster as well. So while the story is not a true story, some of the themes in there were things that affected me very strongly as a youngster. Like, so for example, that part of the world right now is just like this, it's just like this exclusive rich person getaway, like some of these hotels, not some of these hotels, I can't afford to visit there. But when I was there, that whole area was nothing. And what I mean by nothing, it was not yet developed and was a place of astounding beauty. So and I also was young enough to actually see that area being clear cut. Like, I saw the bulldozers, I saw the smoke, mm-hmm. I saw the places where once I was just untouched rainforest, and the next year is smoke and bulldozers. And there's a lot of issues that come with that, not necessarily the on the nose ones where you think are not necessarily linear, good and bad. There's just a lot. There's a lot to think about for my young self, and I think some of those thoughts and themes came through in the book, if one could say, yeah, how the inspiration came.
Okay. So you've written a lot of short stories, and now we have the novel. How has your writing changed between the two? Do you find that your process has changed a lot?
I think maybe I'm just more experienced in that, or I laugh at myself when I say this, but maybe I'm more experienced in knowing what size an idea is. Now that I've written different, you know, I've written in different lengths. I've written a novella, I've written novels, I've written short fiction, I've written flash fiction. And sometimes I'm like, oh, hey, this is a flash fiction, you know, 50,000 words later, you know. So I'm getting better at having an idea about where ideas can fit into boxes that you can share with other humans. That might be it.
Okay. Brennan or Patrick, you guys have any, or shall I keep?
I would love to jump in and kind of, I'm so glad that we brought up the whole idea of, you know, writing in Central America, and you actually kind of let us into that, because it's not just this book either. When I read The Night Marchers, I was really intrigued by how many of the stories in that book take place in different, you know, different places. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a cool
with
cover,
that
man.
Gorgeous, striking cover.
Damn. But you can only see on the video version.
Oh, okay.
So get on YouTube.
That's why I said that.
for audio people, Dan Sauer cover, very beautiful work. Thanks.
It
to
is.
Dan Sauer.
It's trippy too, man.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Brandon.
No,
Central America.
You can interrupt him all you want.
Hey, I'm not John Langan. I don't have kind of credit.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
fall back to that
keeps
feud.
Going.
Exactly. By the way, I got to meet Daniel. I don't even remember what it was. I think it was.
It was at the Lovecraft Arts and Sciences Council. A fantastic.
I just don't remember how long ago.
Yeah, time is timey-wimey, but that was in June of last year for the book launch. They hosted the book launch of the new Night
really
Watchers.
Cool.
Yeah, so it was. It was great to talk to you there. We had a some good conversation in the break. I remember we
and
were
John
talking
Langan
about...
was supposed to come, but he blew us off. So,
oh stop,
that asshole. And we can say that about him because we go back and forth. For those that are unaware,
I remember we had a good conversation about music, and I think it was like one of those fun conversations where it was a great conversation, but like at the end, I think like I was like, wait a minute, you're talking about black metal? I'm talking about jazz. You're talking about black. I think you're talking about death metal and black metal, and I'm talking about jazz. And we were like, I think we're talking about the same thing, but I don't know. At least that was like my impression. Do you listen to a lot of metal?
I don't. Maybe okay. That might have been Rich Gerlach that brought that up. I probably was steering the conversation towards jazz, if I'm honest.
Towards what? Towards what?
Towards jazz.
Okay, so then maybe it was maybe you were the jazz. It was you, I, and Rich were having the talk in between there. My time and memory and age are melting into the pot of rambling podcasters.
Now, I actually do want to come back to the music thing, because that is a huge focus in a lot of your work. But before we do that, you know, with the idea that, you know, Central America and different, you know, tropical places, I feels like a lot of tropical places around the world make up the focal point. I wonder, do you ever have concerns about writing about other cultures? Or is that just something that you've been to a lot of these places, you know a lot about them, and you feel like you can write about them in kind of the most respectful manner possible?
If I had to pick if I have to pick between one of the two, it'll be the second one. Mm-hmm. Because that's a given about being with respect, at least for me. At first, it was not a concern because I was just writing. I was just writing what I knew. But now it's definitely. I'm not sure if it falls to the level of a concern, but it's definitely something that's on my mind, and not necessarily on my mind when I'm writing a story, but it's on my mind because I am a white guy writing about a different part of the world that's not mine. So yeah, I think being awareness and respect is definitely key. You have a lot of different. There's a lot to unpack with that, and which is great because it goes to that footnote. But what I said, one of the things that I like about Lucius Shepard, and one of the things that's important about Lucius Shepard. So Lucius Shepard was, you know, he couldn't be more of a white American in the late 1970s, 1980s. And he was being published in Asimov's and Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And not to throw stones at anyone, because those are great publications. But in the introduction to, one of the things I like to do is collect the original appearances of my favorite short stories and see the context of them. So I'm not sure if it was in the introduction to Lucius Shepard's. It may have been an introduction to James Tiptree Jr., AKA Al Sheldon, who also had a couple of stories in there that were about Central America. And dear God, the introductions to those stories are the most racist, awful things you can imagine. It's like, now writing about the savages in this part of, and it's like, no, this isn't turn of the century. This isn't Lovecraft. This is like still in the 1970s and 1980s. And you have this like racist piece of shit introduction to the area. And it's just like, boom, you know, we've made some progress. We've got a lot of ways to go. So one of the great things about Lucius Shepard, and particularly his big story, The Jaguar Hunter, is his main character and point of view character is a Latino man. And that wasn't, if that was done, you know, I don't know if it, I don't know if his was the first doing that, but it is just, it's effortless, it's seamless, it's beautiful, it's respectful. You don't even think about it. And I didn't think about that aspect when I was first reading The Jaguar Hunter, but I think about it now. I'm not sure if anyone was thinking about it then, but it's just a thing. And I think I don't think there's a, what I have to say isn't right or wrong about it. I don't think there's any right answer. There's a continuum. But the only thing that I will land on and stand behind is, you know, awareness and respect and listening is definitely the starting point and the ending point of that, no matter what comes in between that sandwich.
Yeah, well said. All right. Let's go back to music then. So, again, not just in this book, in The Serpent's Shadow, where your main character is a musician and that really impacts a lot of the lens that they kind of see the world through, but there's so much music in The Night Marchers. So I guess the big question, the vague overall question that you can take in any direction you like is, what's the role of music in your storytelling?
Yeah, it's there. it's there a lot. I think that's one of the fun accidental things where like I didn't plan that, but you know, when you take a look at a book and you collect it and you know, you get five or six stories either about music or people are musicians or taking place at concerts, you're like, you know, things that make you go, you know, I think that's just one of the things. Yeah, where I think it's part of the organic nature of writing and the theme, like where like when crafting things, you're going to write about things that you're interested in and comfortable with and in awe of. And in The Night Marchers, that came out in a lot of different ways, you know, going from the title story, which is called Music of the Spheres. The music is front and center where the story is about and was intended to be about, like, yeah, like some the magic, quote unquote, or something supernatural about music itself. Or you have other stories where they're a ghost story or it's something completely different, but the characters are musicians. So it's saying something completely different about it. And putting them all together in a book, it just had the unintended effect of being about music, which was just sort of a happy thing that happened.
Okay, similarly vague question. What's the role of music in your life?
Wow, I can't. If I had a religion, it would be music. You know, I just, I eat, sleep, drink, dream, constantly thinking about music, dreaming about music. Oddly enough, the one time I probably am not listening to music or thinking about music is when I'm writing. I'm not one of those writers that writes to music unless I'm in a public place, which is something I like to do. But then it's probably because I'd just be distracted if I were like to sit and like, all right, let's sit down and write, put on some great music. I'd spend like 3 hours trying to curate what I'm going to listen to and not get anything done, you know?
I think that's a Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that's a common answer, though. It's like, it seems like when that subject comes up among musicians or even people who are just like live and die by music, they can't write to music because it's too distracting, you know. And it's not just, you know, stuff with lyrics. It's even, you know, I can't write to instrumental stuff because I'm paying too much attention to it and not to what I'm supposed to be paying attention to. So, yeah, that answer doesn't surprise me at all.
Oh, well, I guess I'm glad I found a tribe in that way, because the answer that I hear a lot is people, they do like to curate and they like to almost like use it to kickstart. You know, they're like, oh, this is my go-to for this. This is my go-to for that. And I'm like, that's awesome. That's cool. Yeah. So, yeah, it's cool that there's as many different answers as there are writers out there.
There you go.
That was interesting. We're talking about music. So I'm going to go back to the Serpent Shadow. About Feliz Navidad was like the theme of that area in the book, and talking about how if you're a newer writer and you're hearing people be talking about how you should be respectful or whatever, like some might think that they might roll their eyes or not, but it is the job, in my opinion, of the writer to be truthful. And in that truth, like you gotta try harder than things you've been taught before. And as a guy that loves history and certain specific times and geographical locations of history, you learn a lot that was never ever taught to you unless you go to a college that you're studying that specific topic. And a lot of it's not good. Like the Korean War, I'm super obsessed with. Guess what? Americans were just as fucked up as North Korea, as the Chinese army, as South Korea. Like there's a lot of bad on all areas and all sides. I'll end my rant on that war now, but just to bring it back home with you there, Daniel, you do it in a way in the Serpent Shadow where you're not shoving it down our throat. And I just wanted to say props on you for that.
Well,
and,
yeah, you got to call it like you see it on both sides. I wrote this long before the TV show The White Lotus, but I do recommend watching the TV show The White Lotus, especially the title story of The Night Marchers happens to be set in Hawaii and deals with the same subject. But one of the dangers of writing the way I do, and one of the dangers of the Serpent Shadow is, yeah, it looks like there's a lot of ugly Americanism on display. And there's a thing about, and I don't know how to do it, but there's a thing about presenting, like, so do we not write about the ugliness of the world? And I think we maybe try not to glorify it or not. I don't know. I can't say how you do or you don't, but I would just say there's a difference between presenting ugly truths and perhaps glorifying them. So yeah, the Serpent Shadow, as one, it's like in my first elevator pitch is where I said, yeah, it starts out looking like perhaps like a schlocky horror movie where it's just like, yeah, we're kids on vacation, and you know, there are so many ugly and dangerous tropes out there, and the Serpent Shadow looks like it's going to be one of those tropes. You know, just like, you know, outsiders, kids from America coming to Cancun and just being oblivious, judgmental, intentionally or otherwise. And yeah, that was a truth that I experienced when I was there, you know, as a young impressionable kid. I was just like, what the actual fuck, And I don't know what that says about me. It says something, but maybe at a young age, my eyes were open and I couldn't turn my brain off. Whereas some people just might take things, you know, I don't want to, I do judge people, you know,
everybody does.
Well, no, I want to judge racist pieces of shit for what they are, but, you know, some people, everyone deals with being in that situation differently, right? So maybe some people, it's just, I don't know how they deal, but yeah, for me, I dealt with it by, not looking away from it. And it was something I carried with me. And I wanted to write about it truthfully. And I guess, The Serpent Shadow is a story about that part of the world, but it's very much from an outsider's perspective. In the story, the title story, The Night Marchers, from the Night Marchers of the Strange Tales, I'm pretty sure that is actually from the point of view, I think it's maybe even a much more dangerous thing. I didn't think about it when drafting it, but that is from a Native Hawaiian's perspective, maybe a similar theme. And so maybe that's a much more something, deserving much more scrutiny or evaluation.
When you were writing about how it is down in parts of Central America, it reminded me, like, I was fortunate enough where my wife brought me to on a cruise for my 30th. And one of the stops was when America had a very narrow window of, I think, maybe 2 or maybe 3 years of going to Havana, Cuba, through a cruise. And I had a similar takeaway where you're like, it is gorgeous. But here's the thing, like, everything's heavily regulated by the government. And that's why they got cars that stop in like the 50s. But the buildings, they were gorgeous. Only they were just like not well maintained. There were packs of wild dogs everywhere. Like, I've never experienced this kind of anxiety before, but me and Tara walking in this like flea market, everyone knows you're American, and they're all just, most of them are just calling our name. And I'm like, Tara, I got to get out of here. This is my fucking brain feels like it's all buzzing around. And like, you feel bad because they can't choose to leave that situation. So I just wanted to share that with you. I thought it was really well told. The love story you created, man, that was there were a lot of twists and turns on that. That was some crazy shit. And then I'm not going to say the part, but there's one scene where chaos ensues. And it reminded me of Ronald Kelly's Fair, where there is a similar creature. It was fun in the way where us horror fans have fun with scary things because it's on the page. I thought you did that well as well. I keep saying that. Someone else should jump in. I'm repeating myself a lot.
Well, you know what? I think Brendan asked, how much does genre come into play, when I'm writing? This story happened to be one of the ones. I wrote it quite some time ago already. It was written maybe around 10 years ago, but it was one that I knew that I was writing it, that it would be considered for Cemetery Dance. So when I was writing it, part of what I had in mind was writing what I believe might be my perceptions of horror. Whereas, and for me, that meant a lot of the times in my writing, some things that might be a hallmark of horror, again, not true, just again, in my perception, would be some things like just the level of, like, look at the video game, the gore meter. A lot of the times in my fiction previously, my personal choice was, it's scarier what you don't see. And I just had just that perception in here. I'm like, okay, this is a story where I feel the point to pull back or stop the camera. I'm going to keep the camera rolling because I know that my editor from Cemetery Dance wants to see this. And Cemetery Dance is horror, and horror means this. I think it's a really simplistic and maybe not even accurate observation, but it was an observation that I had when I was writing it. Therefore, there is some of the more violent or bloodier depictions in my work in this particular story, just for that particular notion.
I think it's kind of an astute observation, though, because it's not, you're not saying I changed my style necessarily to cater to a horror magazine, horror, you know, venue. It's that you still wrote a story in your style. You just, as you put it, you left the camera rolling a little bit longer. So maybe you have a way, it sounds to me like you have a way of writing stories where the implication is, can be stronger than the actual, you know, violence. And if you know that this particular piece is going to a certain place that likes the violence, or that, you know, is focused in that direction, then you say, okay, well then I'm going to take that thing I do, and I'm going to stretch it. I'm going to bend it. You know, we're bending those rules again. That's interesting. That just caught my attention. No real question there, but.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it is interesting because it's something I think about a lot. I think about structure a lot. So, and I am a self, you know, self-educated student of horror. I'm like, well, what is horror? When I look at these best horror stories or stories in the best of the year or the best horror stories, I try to say, oh, what are they shaped like? What are certain things that are recurring in them? So, yeah. So, like, you know, I just see a lot of, that's why I don't call them rules. I call them hallmarks. Cause, you know, at least for me, I'm interested in what you three said in the beginning of this. Is like, I'm interested in that place where the rules bend or it's outside the rules. But then if we're going inside the box, and again, there's no judgment between whether it's horror that's inside the box or horror on the borderlands. For me, I'm trying to figure out how to write inside the box, you know, and not on any judgment, just like, oh, I guess I'm a horror writer now. So I should know how to write a horror story, or I'll have to put it out there. It's kind of funny. I still think if I try to hit that mark, I miss. I'm not exactly sure I'm capable of it or could do it on demand. But it is something that's incredibly fun, and I love to learn and try and think about it. One of the things that came to mind is endings. And I think certain aspects of when I'm looking at a lot of classic horror or 80s horror or 70s horror, how people choose to wrap things up or certain structures, you could take the same story and end it at a different point, and maybe it's a different kind of story. And that was really on my mind with The Serpent Shadow. You know, when I the ending that you see is the original ending that I turned in to my editor. I want to shout out to my editor, Norman Prentice, who acquired the book. He's an incredibly talented author. But I second-guessed myself, and we went back and forth on that ending. And I wrote different endings for the book until we came back and Norman gave me the you know, the courage and the self-confidence. He's like, no, Brahm, that's ending it at this point is where it ends if it's a horror story. You know, if I had kept the camera rolling, as maybe some of the other endings did, maybe it takes the emphasis around the quote-unquote horror of that ending, which was, without giving spoilers, it ends on a realization or it ends on a choice. And I think a lot of horror, at least what I'm thinking of classical horror, has those endings where things end on a choice that's either unexpected or having horrific consequence. And if you keep the camera rolling and focus on other things, I mean, it's still that aspect is still there, but maybe now you're thinking about the story is shifting into other territory and the focus is there. So not a question, just sort of becoming a more of an esoteric observation, you know, to may or may not be relevant to anything other than my own observation.
No, but it is a conversation that could go on for hours with no definitive right answer.
I don't think there is. Beauty is there is no right answer.
I saw a post like that today, something along the lines of, you know, if it ends on a happy note, it can't be horror. And it's like, ooh, that's a long ass conversation. But that we're not going to have, we're not going to dive into right now because we have no right answer.
Absolutes are for Sith only. Only Sith deal in absolutes.
There you go.
Let me just throw one thing
we
in there.
We could jump in, into that. What do you want to say, Patrick?
I just wanted to say.
You knew I was next.
Okay.
Go ahead, Patrick.
I just want to say that with a book, like a book, just because it's the last page, don't mean that's the end of their story. That's just the end of that chapter. So to think like that's, you know, that's a happy ending. Well, just for that section of their life, you know, I don't know. That's how I look at it. That's all I was going to say. Go ahead,
okay.
Queen.
Well, I don't really have a question, but since we were speaking about roles, Daniel, I've read, I'm pretty sure, just about all of your work now. And there's a reason why I've read it and why I happen to like it as much as I do. It's because you're not actually a horror writer. You tend to weave in and out of all types of different styles, themes, sci-fi and dark fiction and dark fantasy. There's a lot of magic to what you write and within the things that you write, which I happen to like. Is that an intentional thing or does it just tend to appear? Because a lot of your stories that I have read and even this one had a theme of there was a hint of magic in there and dark fiction and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I happen to like the fact that you don't try to, I'm a horror writer for this novel and this is how I'm going to write it. You stick true to the way you write and you kind of weave everything in it around the story.
Well, I think I really appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate that kind compliment. And that's no diss to horror. I really appreciate that compliment. I also think it's also a part of the beauty of horror itself, where horror is a big enough umbrella, where it's big enough to actually cover someone like me. I might just be right under the edge of that umbrella. Where you're like, bro, I'm like, you kind of weave and like, you're sort of under the umbrella and you're most of the time under the umbrella, but you're not in the middle under that umbrella of horror. And I've learned that that's okay. Like to some people, I'm not going to be their cup of tea. They're going to be like, happy ending, you're out. I don't have happy endings, but, or you have magic, you're not. You know, I used to get like some criticism where like, that was a pretty good story. Except it's not horror. this is clearly a story about magic. I have a story, you know, the same thing was like, that's a decent story, but it's clearly with the presence of the rocket ships clearly indicate this is science fiction. And you know what, like, I don't subscribe to that point of view, but it's okay for everyone does have their point of view. Like the person, whoever they are, if they say horror can't have happy endings, I'm not going to argue with their truth. If that's their truth to them, where it's not hard to them, all right, that's your truth. You know, go read. There's plenty of other things that you could read. But that's not my truth. And I think the truth, one of why I'm just so fascinated and excited, and I will be eternally a student of horror, is the broadness of the umbrella of work that can be said to what is horror and what is horror fiction. And just really, I'm always just super excited and humbled by for you to say something like that, Candace. Thank you.
It's this has been one of those things that I mention a lot. So horror to me is as different as it is to me, to Patrick, to you, to Brennan, to every person who reads it or experiences it. And whenever people ask me what defines horror, my answer, generally speaking, is life. Life is the epitome of horror because every horror story that we can possibly conceive of is woven within every single element of life. It has all of those elements and all of the human experiences in life wrapped into the story. Without that, we wouldn't have a horror story, would we? We would have people who don't feel, people who don't have love, and people who don't lose things, and there's no loss, there's no grief, there's no pain. If we didn't feel pain, if we didn't have fear, like, horror can be any aspect of your life, and it all depends on how you interpret what you're afraid of, what scares you. So sci-fi, oh, you got a spaceship, you got a rocket ship. Yeah, what if that son of a bitch blows up and you're the only astronaut there? That's horror, is it not? If you're the astronaut on that ship, you're telling me you're not scared? You just dropped the load in your pants because you're the only one left. Your spaceship was blown up in half. And tell me that, oh, that's sci-fi. No, dude, that's horror. Because if you were the man surviving on that ship, tell me you wouldn't be scared of that, right? There's horror in every single aspect of what we do. When we're sitting around watching our loved ones grow old and they age and our parents die, you tell me that's not horror. When they're wasting away from just illnesses and diseases, and maybe it's not a slasher that comes in the room and kills them, but is that not 6 months of watching them waste away? Is that not one of the most horrifying experiences of your life? That's horror. Anything that involves human experience and human emotion involving pain and grief and loss, that is horror. When your child dies, when you get into a car wreck, that PTSD that comes after that car wreck, that's horror. That's a horrifying experience. Not everything has to end with a slasher in it. There's no happy endings in horror, are there not? What is the final girl trope? Somebody please tell me what that is. Would it be called the final girl trope if a final girl was not alive? Is that not a happy ending? Did she not survive? Did she not, you know, escape the killer or overpower the killer or take down the killer? Is that not a happy ending? Somebody survived the aftermath. That's a happy ending. So by the very definition of them saying there's no happy endings in horror, you just left out a whole trope, because what is the final girl thing that we all worship and talk about and speak of? Oh, she's the final girl. She's the final girl. Yeah? Well, isn't that a happy ending?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, because that irritates me. It is what we make it. It is what we fear. It is the things that we experience as humans. It is our story. It's what scares us. It's what we have experienced, overcome, witnessed, lost, what has hurt us. It's everything. Horror is the only genre that can do that.
I'm with you. You know what? I'm with you. That's why horror is the superior genre for me, for all the reasons you do. For all the reasons you said, and it plays nice, and as you said, much more eloquent than me, it not only plays nice, it is present in every other genre. You know, you can take any of the, well, like, how
the Bible. Challenge you,
right, or say, like, how can you say Alien? Tell me science fiction Alien is not horror, or a million other examples. And that was actually quite brilliant. Like, I think it's like a really brilliant analysis of the final girl trope and slashers, you know. I'm fascinated with Giallo and the pushing of the board, of how people have pushed the borders of that. I love so it's brilliant. I'm gonna quote you, definitely my new favorite quote is that horror is life, because the kind of horror I'm interested in is exactly that.
Yeah.
Some people are just, maybe I'm just not as angry at them. I don't mean to be dismissive, even though I'm just kind of dismissive. There's a lot of levels of thickness or thinness. There is horror without that, but it's pretty basic, you know, or pretty gateway, you know. Like I'm just not it's that sort of, if there's no life in it, as Candace said, it's got to have something special to hold my attention for very long, and it just doesn't.
I just because I'm on my horse now about this. So
you're doing good. Keep going.
Listen.
Yeah, go.
Just as an example. So there's a podcast that I listen to religiously, and it's nuts. It's one man. He writes all the stories and he narrates them all. and they're random and they're sporadic when it happens. So whenever he drops a new one, I'm all over it. He wrote a story one time. The title is called Staircase, I think. The entire story is about 37 minutes long. And it is this man who experiences a single creak in the middle of the night on his staircase. He's in the house alone, average man, accountant type office man. He's not a rugged mountain man. He's not military. He's just an average guy alone in his house. And he hears this creak on the staircase in the middle of the night. When he went upstairs, he was alone. He knew his house was locked up. He knew he had checked all the windows and the doors, and there was a creak in the middle of the staircase. That tension that built throughout the story from that one singular event drove me insane. I was terrified the whole time, like waiting to see, like just waiting along with this man alone in his room to see what that creak on the staircase was. And of course, he did the human things that we would all do. You run through the mental checklist. Did I check the front door? Did I lock the window? Did I lock the kitchen door? And then you do those other human things that we do where we're very quiet in our room. We become still. We become as quiet as possible. And we're listening. And we're waiting to hear it again. Hear it again. Hear it again. All of this tension was built on this single human moment from just a single noise on the staircase. Was that a horror story or not? Scared the hell out of me. It scared the hell out of the man in his house who knew he was alone.
I think there's a long tradition. It follows a long tradition right back to the beginning of horror with the master Edgar Allan Poe, who writes about very human things like that. Like he'll write a whole story about just being really paranoid and suspicious about being watched by a really sketchy looking bird. I mean, I think,
yeah.
There's just a lot of, it's long tradition of that.
It's human. It's human. It's those things that bring that nudge to the back of our spine. It's those things that scare us and makes our blood run cold in the middle of the night because something is wrong. You know something is wrong. And hey, maybe I'll hear that sound and maybe I won't get that scared, but maybe the guy downstairs from me would hear that sound and be terrified the rest of the night. It is defined as human experience, and what scares me may not scare the guy next to me or the person beside them, but I think horror is the superior genre in the fact that it is the only one that it can virtually wrap every human experience and emotion into a singular story, and you are still left with a horror story.
Yeah, take that, romance.
You can have, you know, dude, you can have romance. Tell me again. I'm going to let you rethink that real quick. What is the hardest hitting emotion in horror? What is the number one used device in horror? We lose a loved one, don't we? The main character loses the love of their life. The newlyweds get slashed up. The husband loses his aging wife. Tell me that romance is not naturally built in and woven into just about every horror story out there, because the greatest horror, our greatest fear as humans, is being left alone. Our greatest fear is losing our loved one, losing our mate, our companion, our child, our mother, that person closest to us that is our support network. That is mankind's greatest fear. So go ahead, romance. Every single horror story written, there is an element of love and loss wrapped into that story. That is the number one aspect of a horror story. You're losing the thing that you hold most dear. Okay. Romance. There you go.
Agreed. I was trying to it's crack a joke, horror. But you're too smart.
It is the only thing that can envelop the entirety of the human experience. And I will preach that until I die. There's no other genre out there that will completely wrap all the human experiences into their singular story except horror.
one of my favorite Stephen King, if not my favorite Stephen King book, is book four of The Dark Tower. If anyone's read The Dark Tower out there, Wizard of Glass is the most gut-wrenching, heartbreaking romance and loss. Mm-hmm. You know, right up there with Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hard to argue with that. Going right along with life, maybe even something more so than life and experience. I'm thinking about something author Tim Powers once said at a guest of honor speech. And I'm not sure if Tim Powers is considered horror. He's maybe one of those horror adjacent writers. And I'm not even sure he was talking about horror, but I feel like what this thing that's coming to mind, I say it a lot, but it's right up there with what Candace is saying. He was saying his job as the writer, as the genre writer, as the horror writer, is to tap into something so primal and so essential to us that we're not even necessarily aware of it, where our conscious thought breaks down. He used this example, and you know, maybe trigger warning here, because it's possibly, you know, it deals with animals. There was an experiment done in a chicken farm, and this particular chicken farm was chickens who never seen the sun. Generations of them, they were just indoors, you know, which I think is pretty cruel. But these particular, so you have generations of animals that had never been outside. So it's like its mother couldn't have told, oh, this is what the sun looks like, or its grandma, you know, it just had, these animals had no way of knowing what it was like outside. And the experiment was they took a hawk or a chicken hawk or a model of one, and they put it on a line and they ran it across the ceiling, and all the chickens obviously just freaked out. These chickens had never seen a hawk before. They'd never seen the sun or a silhouette. They had no idea what a predator was, but there's something baked into them. There's something just baked into their being that they just knew that this was fear. And I think Tim Powers righteously said, you know, the job of the writer, and I'll bend it to say the job of a horror writer, is to tap into that, whichever that is.
Yeah, there's definitely some stuff on the gene level that, you know, as people or animals fear. Like, I have a pet pig. I learned they don't like being picked up because they have that instinct from when they were, you know, some in the wild, predators pick them up, and they die after that. So
it's that flight or fight instinct. It is what kicks in when we are afraid. That is what kicks in. It is that primal animalistic instinct. You cannot control that impulse. It is the human instinct to survive at any cost.
Absolutely.
You fight or you flight. And that's what we try to show, I think, in every horror story that we write. We show that human instinct to survive whatever that obstacle is, whatever that fear is. We are trying to show the reader there's a way to survive this. You can get through this. This is how my character is going to get through this major event, this catastrophe, this traumatic incident. It's fight or flight. It's the instinct to survive. No matter what your circumstances are, you're going to fight until there's nothing left to survive it. It is just human instinct.
I like the idea of horror as being a vehicle, or that horror is at its core about life and about humanity and about humanism. And I think that is, even though, again, it is on the outer borderlands or the outer side of that umbrella, I think that's, that was a gift that Cemetery Dance and horror and learning about horror gave to me. Whereas the kind of horror I write isn't necessarily about the knife, or it's not even about the vampire, you know. And you have a story where it's like, yeah, the rules, the vampire, you must cut off its head, bury it under the river, and or whatever the rules are. If you have stories, be it fight or flight for trauma, or be it where it's not about defeating the monster or any of these tropes, or you're playing with the tropes. Well, what's left? It's left with the human stories. And now horror can be this vehicle to tell the human stories, which begs the question, well, why don't you just write literature, or why don't you just write non-supernatural stories? And I'm like, well, maybe I'm just not interested. You know, I write that
because no one would read that. We don't write that because it's a watered down version of life. We already live that.
Some of it is absolutely amazing and fascinating. And I particularly like, if I'm not going to have supernatural in my story, I at least want there to be the specter or the chance of supernatural in my story. And a lot of what I do intentionally, and a lot of what I work on and work for, is playing with that notion of, is this supernatural? Or is this psychological? And it doesn't matter for me. Not only is it not important where it lands, I'm much happier if I read a story where I don't know where it lands. Because then it's
Tremblay effect.
Yeah. Is that that you call that the Tremblay effect? Yeah. Tremblay effect, the Robert Aikman effect, the Shirley Jackson. For me, that's the chef's kiss of a story because it lands on what Candace is going back to Candace's life umbrella, because now the focus is not on, and there's nothing wrong with those other kind of stories. I take great joy in them, but there's also a great joy in the stories that wind up being about something else in our horror. And that's what I love. And hopefully I try to deliver that.
Oh, you do every time. Like, you nail it. That was my main point, though. You write the human stories. You write those human experiences and those emotions, and you weave everything else into this absolute, just amazing story. I don't think we all have to say, I'm a horror author, I'm only sci-fi, I'm only this. I try not to just be a horror author as well. I do some extreme, I do some splatterpunk, I'm branching out into some other stuff now. But I like those that can write the human experiences and the human stories and weave that other stuff in it. Mm. And that's what you do extremely well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
I'm done talking.
All right, so now this is a clumsy way to do this, but now we're going to go to the winding down portion of the show where we ask, where can people follow you, Daniel?
You can find me on the social media usual places under my name. I do have a YouTube channel, which is under my name. I think if you put in Daniel Brom, you'll be able to see me on YouTube as well.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a series called Nighttime Logic. It's moved online since pandemic times. But yeah, that was a series where I did, where Peter Straub, where it began the episode, was a guest. Went back when it was in person only. But yeah, you can under Daniel Brom on YouTube. I do a monthly Nighttime Logic series of talking about that very kind of horror or that kind of fiction. And you can connect with my books, of course, all the big bookstores, but you can ask for it at your local independent bookstore. The Green Hand bookstore in Maine is an indie bookstore that carries my work if you're looking to support indie bookstores. And also Indie Publishers Cemetery Dance, online or cemeterydance.com. You can find my books there.
Excellent. Candace, where can people follow you?
Social media, Uncomfortably Dark, or under my name.
Brennan, where can people follow you?
The internet.
All right. Okay. The internet. Just look, you know where. So you can follow me at Pierre McDonough. Follow the show at Deadhead Space. We're on as far as I know, pretty much all the platforms. Daniel, do you have any final thoughts?
Just want to say thank you so much for promoting horror, for supporting things that you love, and supporting indie and all sorts of horror. And thank you for including me in that. It's really been a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
It's been a long time coming, man, for you to for us to talk with you.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm actually going to have Brennan go last, and I'll go with kind of I mixed your names, I think.
Go ahead,
I'm not
Kenneth.
Sure. I'm Candace. I don't know who Kenneth is. Maybe 30 Rock. I don't know why I'm thinking 30 Rock.
So final thoughts before Patrick, you know, just keeps going. I just wanted to say thank you for your time and spending an hour and a half with us here talking about horror. And everyone should go and pick up your new novel because it's fantastic.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My final thoughts are, I agree. Serpent Shadow was just really great. It was got pretty creepy at times too, man. I'm not sure I want to go messing around with any, not that I did before, but any Mayan gods. Holy shit.
You won't
do that again.
Won't do that again. I appreciate your time, Daniel. I know this won't be the first and only time, so can't wait to have you back.
Looking forward to it.
Putting you on the spot.
I'll be back anytime. Just say the word and I'm here.
Excellent. Brennan.
Yeah, no, I'll throw out really quick. Thank you for hanging out with us, Daniel. People should check out The Serpent Shadow and The Night Marchers. And beyond that, I would just have Patrick edit in Candace's Life is Horror monologue a second time so people can just listen to that instead of my rambling final thoughts.
That was really smart. What Candace said, as always, you have made choices in podcasts. Thank you for picking us.